Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 46. Today, we're talking CRISPR GPT and humanoid robots. And we've got Rong with us, who's our newest addition to the genomics team and the real expert here, because Nick, I don't think you are.
Yep, definitely not me, but it's great to be in person.
It is. This is actually filmed during our on-site week, and we're having a good time seeing everyone in person.
Only the second episode in person.
It's true. It's true. All right, so let's kick it off with just catching everyone up. Rong, what is CRISPR?
Okay, so CRISPR is a technology that can that scientists use to like cut out a specific piece of gene. So basically it works by several components. So first you've got the nuclease, which is the cutting like the scissors. And then the second is something you call a guide RNA. It's a guide that tells the scissors like where to cut.
It's like it gives the dotted line.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Kind of like that, yeah. So that's a very like a high level introduction of the CRISPR, just what it does. But if you're like interested, there's definitely like more like nuances and such as like which type of guide RNA to use. And then also just so you know, like there are a lot of like nucleases, which is the Cas, which is the scissors in the CRISPR system. So yeah, so just a high level intro.
We like to keep it high level around here. So how does AI begin to play a role, ChatGPT? How is it being utilized in this space?
Yeah, so here our topic, the CRISPR GPT. So what people does is, so these group of researchers actually started to notice that people are using the general like ChatGPT to design experiments. And then what they found is that the general ChatGPT cannot design a very good experiment. For instance, you ask for something like, hey, I want to knock out a gene. Knockout, by the way, it means that I literally want to like cut off this gene. Like in human, like specific, let's say gene A. And then ChatGPT will tell you a protocol. Maybe that's for mice or maybe that's for plants. So that's not good. So these group of researchers, what they did is they trained their GPT with a lot of like gene editing, meaning like mainly like CRISPR related literatures so that the GPT knows how to like give you the best protocols for in terms of, for instance, like which nuclease or the scissors to use and then which guide RNA to design. So basically I would put it this way. So it's a very efficient way for scientists to like design experiments.
And so are there examples? I know, right, ChatGPT comes out, people say, oh, I cut down this process in my organization by hours. Are there some concrete examples of people using CRISPR GPT yet, or is it still just in the hands of the people who created it?
It is still like an unpublished, but preprint.
Okay.
So preprint like a paper. And I think it's, believe it's still with the people who train the GPT. And then, but based on their experience, it works pretty well because they, what they did is, okay, so I have this like CRISPR GPT, how does it do? So they gave it like a concrete task to knock out like several genes at the same time. And then completely like non, like human in like an interfered design. And then you can just follow exactly what CRISPR GPT tells you. And then they successfully like knocked out those genes, which is not easy to do. So so I would say that's the only case it's been used, but I do have confidence that this will be used more and more because I can tell you, like as a researcher myself. So normally a grad student, meaning like a PhD trainee, the trainee students, like what they will do is for CRISPR experiment, depend on the organisms, organism meaning you're working on mice or like human cell lines. It could take anywhere from like 9 months to 3 years.
Wow. Wow.
To successfully knocking down one gene. So
why? Crazy.
Yeah, it is so crazy. So basically like think about like a PhD in 5 or 6 years, the majority of the time you're creating your like your mutant lines, so meaning that you're knocking down a specific gene. So for instance, like my friend, like she works with mice, and then she took like 3 years to just knocking out that specific gene she wants to study, and then took another 3 to actually do experiments.
Wow.
So why is this process, this CRISPR GPT important, is that during the 3 years, what she does is, so she has to like skim through the literatures. There are like thousands of literatures. She couldn't like get them all at once because, you know, like human, that we have enough time,
yeah,
we have like energy limitation. So she would like skim through the literature. And then after, for instance, after she skimmed through the literature, she started to like design experiments and only to find that what she half doesn't work. And then there's another round of like looking into literature and troubleshooting, and then it doesn't work. So I think with the CRISPR GPT, those situations will be alleviated because these GPTs are trained with the existing literatures. So what it will do is it could give you like a better starting point. I'm not saying it's giving you a perfect point as to where to start your experiment, but it at least gives you like a more closer to optimal one. Does that
so,
make sense?
So you think that this could cut down some PhDs from, you know, 6-7 years to 3 years?
Definitely. So I've heard like extremes, just an extreme story here. So like CRISPR, so think about this technology. It doesn't work equally on every gene. So for instance, I want to knock out gene A and it could like knock out gene A, but then if I want to knock out gene B with the same system, it might not work at all. So yeah, so basically another extreme case is if you are working with a gene that's not easy to knock out, and then so basically it could take up to 5 years. So think about the PhD
that's
in
crazy.
6 years. Yeah. So if we could like cut down that time with the better like experiment planning system, and then with like a this system that creates like a gives you a better like optimal better like starting point, I think we could, like our PhD students or even the researchers in the pharma companies could spend like maybe the just like one, cut down the 3 year to like 1 year or even like below 1 year, and spend the rest of the time like to actually work on the scientific discoveries, to actually like find something that's very like very useful. Like, I'm not saying that creating these knockouts are not useful. It's just we need to do this more efficiently.
And just to understand this, you're saying there are some times when you're going out and you're researching and you're creating an experiment, mm-hmm. and it could be that another PhD candidate has already tried this and you have no idea because you're not caught up on the literature, and you could have spent a year or two trying the same exact experiment someone else has.
Exactly.
And you're saying that, you know, if you have a system that can read through all the literature, mm-hmm.
for
understand
you,
it, you can be, you know, much more efficient as a whole research body,
yes.
across the country,
yes.
and actually try to push the boundary instead of potentially duplicating someone else's work that has already failed.
Mm-hmm. That's well said. Because like another thing I want to mention is this is not only like CRISPR GPT. Mm-hmm. So it's very like, I think it's this type of things like using GPT to better help you to like integrate through the literature and then plan your experiments, give you the most like optimal design. I think it should be very useful in the research process in general, because honestly, like when you're do research, like the majority time is you design your experiment, and another chunk of time is like you spend like researching the literature, reading through the papers. So for me, like I used to read like around like 40-50 papers like per week.
Wow.
But then that was a lot.
40-50 yeah. posts on X a day. that's the limit.
Yeah, but then like if like in an area there's like thousands of papers, and for instance those people doing like protein experiments, they have like thousands or even like 10,000 of experiments. How are they gonna like read through all of that, right? Well, so that's when this comes into play.
That is fascinating, and it will be very exciting to see how this does speed up the progress within the mm-hmm. space, because as you're pointing it out, it seems like there's a ton of inefficiencies. But yeah, thank you for coming on, this was super insightful. Sam, let's switch to you. Humanoid robots, your favorite subject, tell us all about it.
Well, I'd say I'm not going to go all about it. We're going to go select.
Okay.
I will say the most exciting thing that we've seen recently, or in our sphere, right, there's a Tesla bot picking and placing cells in the factory. I think that's pretty cool. But what I wrote about and what we discussed is the topic and debate around humanoid itself, right? And it's like, why humanoid versus something else? Like, legs are complicated, why wouldn't you just put wheels? Hands are complicated, why wouldn't you just put, you know, pinchers? And I think the right way to think about this is to replace humanoid with generalizable. And sure, you can put a wrench at the end of a robot, but then it's not generalizable. It's super good. It's better than human hands at doing a specific task. But the reason that humanoid is so exciting is inherently because of that generalizability. And humans are what the world was created for, to manufacture, right? We didn't mm-hmm. create it for anyone else other than humans. And so when you look at the manufacturing landscape in the US, people tend to think of auto manufacturing. And these are huge firms where they've automated it down to a science over, you know, decades. And sure, there's still human roles there, and that will get replaced over time. But there's this enormous opportunity in the other side, which is small firms, which is, so I'm looking at the numbers here, you know, close to 5 million people in manufacturing work in firms that have less than 500 employees. And that's the vast majority of, not the vast majority, that is the majority of where you're seeing this bucket of people. And those firms are not doing high volume throughput, so they can't have a super specific automation regime where you're hiring someone to come in and program a bot to do something a million times, right? They need something generalizable in order to automate at all.
Mm-hmm. I have two questions. One, standardizing on a humanoid robot, even for those that would claim, you know, you can have single purpose customized robots, couldn't you just swap out different parts of the humanoid robot to fit a specific need at a certain point? As in, maybe, you know, hands are not the best at, you know, screwing in bolts. You just, you know, replace the hand with a wrench or something. I feel like you can just begin to swap out different parts to fit the need. But as long as you have kind of a standardized body, it would make that a possibility from a cost perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And I think the interesting thing will be the design, but also the training, right? If you're doing deep learning and that, it's like you got to then collect all of the data for the robot to like know which part to put in and all of that, where it's like already there's all of the power tools we have are designed for the human hand.
True. That makes sense. Yeah. Second question, the Optimus video, was this just Threads FUD or was it actually teleoperated and they're collecting data by doing that? And what is that the purpose of having it teleoperated, or did someone recreate a video and create some fake AI that was meant to discredit the video itself? So I haven't seen it on X, so I don't know what the truth is.
Yeah, exactly. That's where truth lies. There were multiple parts of the video. In one part of the video, you see a line of Optimi, if you will.
Yeah, Optimi.
And they're being trained. They're being teleoperated for training purposes. But then there is part of it where it's showing the robot in the factory picking and placing cells. And I believe Elon posted saying that this was not teleoperated. There was no human in the loop in this as well. So there were, you know, both instances in the video.
Okay.
But there is definitely the case of no human in the loop and it executing a task.
So taking the training data of the teller operation and actually implementing it. And that's the second video.
Exactly. Video. And I think that's also a good point, right? Collecting the huge amount of data, right? Tesla's doing it with vehicles on the road. There's not necessarily assets in the field to collect the data you need for humanoid robots. And so that's being done with, you know, synthetic data, but synthetic data is only so good. It's being done with teleoperation, right? Some people are strapping GoPros on factory workers to collect the data from what they're doing.
I would imagine that it takes much less training data to do some of these tasks, as in there's not a lot of edge cases that can happen when you're just taking a battery cell off a conveyor belt and putting it into a rack. You know, not much is going to go wrong that's going to throw the robot off its task.
There's no cells that are drunk driving.
Right. So, I mean, I guess from that standpoint, you could begin to knock out pretty simple tasks with a small amount of training data if you were to, you know, outline and say, here are some of the easiest tasks a humanoid robot can knock out today with, you know, the highest return for us. We can, you know, train this in, I would imagine, a couple of days, months. How much training data do you think they actually needed to create the video of the one robot?
I think you're right. I think it's less than you would imagine. Right? And I think other humanoid robot companies out there have been on record saying, you know, maybe like 50 to 100 attempts and they can get pretty good at a specific task like this.
Right. Interesting.
I actually have a question. So like I'm not an expert in that, but I'm just wondering, like, do you know the cost for to train like a humanoid robot?
That's a great question. I do not know. Okay. And at least the cost for the robot itself varies greatly currently. You know, Elon's said getting it down to like half the price of a car, I believe. I think in China there's some for sale in like the $45,000-$50,000 range. On the training side, I think it is similar to the arms race that we're seeing across the board for models, and I imagine that Tesla and others are going to be utilizing whatever large, you know, compute clusters they have access to. So yeah, I don't have a concrete answer there, but it's definitely something we should get into.
But the reason I'm asking is for, because you're talking about these like humanoid robots for like small manufacturing things, like not so many repetitive things. I think they could potentially be used in those specialized labs setting.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because in the lab, like we probably work until like 10 p.m. or stuff, and then we have to go home and sleep. But then there are like still experiments running. So do you think the humanoid robots can like take over what we are doing and then work at night for us and to increase the productivity?
I definitely think so. I think the interesting question will be, how quickly can humanoid robots take over tasks? Mm-hmm. And exactly to what you're saying, it's like the first thing they're going to do is take over, you know, concrete tasks, right? Mm-hmm. If you're working in a lab, one of your jobs, right, you're going to be micropipetting, mm-hmm. or doing something like yeah. that. But it's like you are super intelligent and you're doing all these other things. You're coordinating with other people and you're saying, this is the next step that we need mm-hmm. to do. And so, you know, we have the potential for the humanoid robot to do the physical side. Mm-hmm. And then it's interesting because it will tie in kind of with the CRISPR GPT or yeah. the Chat GPT. And it's like, how do you get the intelligence for the other bundle of tasks that employee is responsible for?
Do you imagine that this ends up being something where maybe a company begins to ship the hardware? So the actual humanoid robot, you have a general software framework, you know, a model powering this, and then it's, you know, self-training, as in if I were to purchase a humanoid robot, I want it to do specific tasks for me.
So don't fold my sheets like that.
Right. I just, you know, tell or show mm-hmm. the, you know, the humanoid robot a few times how I do this, and it's simply able to just learn and, you know, repeat.
I think that's a potential future.
Right.
Yeah, especially if you can, like if it's already pre-trained and then it's capable. And we've seen this even without humanoid robots, with just collaborative robots, you know, being able to easily train it, drag its arm from here to here and say, like, this is how you pick in place. Like, this is the range of motion I want you to take. Yeah. I think that's definitely a potential outcome for humanoid yeah. robots.
Because they're doing that with the Rabbit R1, which we've seen the reviews, not great. But the idea there is that, you know, they're shipping a product that doesn't have all of the capabilities it can have, but they're allowing users to actually build in those capabilities. So they have a whole testing and training area mm-hmm. for specific users. If you want to show the Rabbit R1 how to navigate a certain app, you can actually do it, you know, several times until it understands how to mimic you. And I would imagine you can replicate that exact process with a humanoid robot for various different tasks.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Maybe, Nick, as we wrap up, you like to make bold predictions about unit sales of various products.
What?
I know. I'm just saying, you got Apple, you got the Vision Pro, you got that one.
That's,
you know,
yes. Sure.
Rabbit R1. How's it going to do?
I think this space is really interesting, and stay tuned. We have a great piece coming out on what we think is going to happen with consumer AI. So very excited to get that out there. It's kind of our whole thesis on, you know, how this could be monetized and how different consumers will use it and who could potentially be winners. I think, you know, what we're seeing is, again, we're very early days, and the market is still not sure if these need to be separate pieces of hardware or potentially apps. I think that's the big debate right now. And everyone that's reviewed the device has said, why isn't this an application? There's very clear reasons. I think we've gone over it in this podcast, why it is its own separate hardware. But I think, you know, fitting it back to how we already navigate the digital world is going to be extremely important. As in, you know, I think it will be attached or tied to different hardware, as in, you know, maybe your smartwatch or your AirPods, but do we need a separate application that Rabbit has built? Probably not. But that has its own implications, right? Because Apple and Google would control, you know, the majority of the smartphone market. And if it just ends up being, you know, an OS level agent, as in Siri becomes as smart as some of the tools out there, ChatGPT, Perplexity, that has its own implications. But, you know, all is discussed in this paper that's coming out from us, so stay tuned. I think what will happen with these devices is a lot of experimentation. It's going to, I think, begin to train habits within users. They're going to be more accustomed to, you know, talking, having conversations instead of just direct querying. If you are thinking about getting any of these devices, I think, just based on reviews and my own personal use, the Meta Ray-Ban glasses, and I know I sound like a broken record, I understand, but they actually have, I think, the best use case for AI. And I actually tweeted about this. And the reason is because...
because it's AI third.
AI third. Thank you, Sam. You read my tweets.
I read your tweets.
You read my tweets.
Your posts.
You read my posts, yes. But it's, you know, I think to train users to get used to having to talk to these AIs because it's more conversational, you have to have use cases they're already familiar with. So with the Ray-Ban glasses, they're a pair of sunglasses first or just normal eyewear. Then it's a camera, which is, it's actually a great camera. And then third is obviously the AI. So it's kind of this Trojan horse into building habits for consumers to understand and to adapt to, you know, to using AI on a consumer level.
Great. Well, Rong, thank you for joining us. We'll see all of you next week, but we won't see all of you next week in person.
I will see.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Rong and I will be hanging out. You'll be gone.
I'll be gone. On just on a screen. All right. We'll see everyone next week.
See everyone.
Bye.